The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
Hey, it's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters close to the stars. And this is episode 439 of the Columbia Calling podcast. Our very special guest will be on the line with us from Sweden. First time I think we've had anyone from Sweden, well, in the location of Sweden, on the Columbia Calling podcast. So very, very lucky as we are to have Jessica Lopez. And she'll be talking really about sustainable land use and, the land transformation taking place in the Amazon. So, of course, we'll be discussing deforestation, the works being done by this government, the past government. What is so special about places like Chiribiquete, places in Caquetá, Guaviare, and so much more. She's an expert in her field, and I think you'll find it's really quite enlightening to talk to her. She speaks very, very well on this topic indeed, and kept me completely rapt the whole way through. Of course, please, please, please look at our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/Columbia Calling and see how you might be able to help the Columbia Calling podcast and its economic viability. Aside from that, of course, we'll be going over to the news brief with Emily Hart, going from strength to strength on that. I get a lot of feedback and reasons why some of the people are turning up and tuning in is due to Emily. So I'm, of course, ever grateful for her diligent work on that. We'll have some interesting episodes in the future. I know that Emily's been talking to a press entity. Hopefully that will be soon. I've got the good news that Daniel Eggington, the adventurer, who has now tried to get through the Darien Gap on its western side, this was his third attempt and he made it. So he'll be back in the UK soon. It was not without some challenges, but he'll be filling us in on his adventure up the western side of the Darien Gap. I've got Simon Faulkner coming on, who's a tourism expert, who's just been to Colombia, and he'll be talking about what's going on in the world of tourism. And of course, he was in Providencia, so he can give us feedback on what really is happening on that island. Jenny Pierce from the London School of Economics will be talking at some point about her report on the elites in Colombia. I hope to get Adam Nunn on, who is an expert in cybersecurity, and we'll put that into the context of Colombia and the region. We have also Kevin McCaffrey, who's a friend to the Columbia Calling podcast. You'll remember a few months ago, or last year, he fell victim to scopolamine and had all of his life savings taken from his bank account. Well, I'm bringing him on because there's a new scam out there, principally in Medellin, but of course it will, I'm sure it extends across the country, directed at freelancers, foreigners, locals, and so on. Quite scary. So I'd like to get him on the show to discuss this scam a little bit because he suffered at the hands of some pretty nefarious people here in Colombia. So interesting episodes in the pipeline for you. So don't go away. We'll be back with Jessica Lopez from Sweden, from Colombia, but in Sweden, talking about her topics of expertise, sustainable land use. She's at the Center for Environmental and Climate Science up there at the University of Lund. And she works at the graduate school there, aiming at the 2030, sustainable targets. So we'll be talking to her. Now over for some words from our sponsors and then on to Emily Hart with the news brief. Thank you again for listening and don't go away.
I'm Emily Hart and these are your top stories for the week of Monday, September 5th, 2022. The first polls on the new government of Gustavo Petro were released this week. The president starts his mandate with a 56% favourability rating, a percentage never reached by his predecessor, Iván Duque, whose approval rating peaked at 52%. A majority of those polled feel that foreign relations are improving and that the government will comply with the peace agreement with the FARC. 55%, however, reject Petro's policy of suspension of hydrocarbon exploration. More than 70% are against legalising drugs, half are against gay marriage, and nearly 60% are against adoption by gay couples. 76% of those polled felt that the best option to solve the issue of the guerrilla and other armed groups is dialogues until peace agreements are reached. 21% opted for trying to defeat them militarily. 69% agree that the government should resume negotiations with guerrilla group the ELN, as it has proposed to do. In less encouraging statistics, the Democratic Republic of Congo was identified as the country most affected by organised crime, followed by Colombia. This is, according to the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organised Crime's ranking, which measures the scope, scale and impact of criminal actors and markets, and a country's ability to respond. Colombia has now seen 74 massacres this year, according to think tank Indepaz. Six indigenous people from the Sucumbíos reservation in Nariño were murdered last week. Their bodies were found along with signs, accusing them of being thieves, immoral, and collaborators with FARC dissidents. Also this week, seven policemen were killed in an attack in Huila, attacked with explosives and rifle shots. The president gave a statement suggesting the likelihood of FARC dissident groups being the perpetrators and calling for a closer relationship between police and community. Meanwhile, a new law to underpin Petro's policy of total peace has been presented to Congress. The bill declares its aim to be human security for the construction of total peace. It proposes a peace cabinet to achieve focused and comprehensive implementation of the agreement with the FARC, which Petro promised in his campaign. The proposal also revives the possibility of peace talks in Colombian territory, in so-called peace regions, in which arrest warrants, including warrants for extradition, would be suspended. Peace talks have previously had to be held abroad in countries like Cuba. The bill also uses the word structures, allowing the possibility of processes with different armed organisations, including criminal groups and drug traffickers, as well as the possibility of reaching partial and not definitive agreements with groups for example, humanitarian reasons. Colombia's Transitional Justice Tribunal, the JEP, are to open a new macro case, investigating crimes by state agents in alliance with paramilitaries and civilian third parties. The case will investigate radicalization of the counterinsurgency movement, stigmatization of civilians, economic benefits gained during the conflict, including land grabs and extortion, and political corruption. Once the macro case has been opened, the chamber will call to testify state agents, including military and police officers, who may have committed crimes directly or who may have been involved in the paramilitary activities. The JEP also plans to open two more macro cases: crimes committed against ethnic peoples and territories, and sexual violence and other crimes motivated by gender, sex, orientation, or gender identity of the victim in the conflict. Since last week, in different parts of Colombia, people have invaded private property, claiming they are implementing Petro's promise that the lands of the Special Assets Society will be put back in the hands of campesino communities. Various members of Petro's cabinet have spoken out, asking people to stop. The Minister of Defence gave them 48 hours to vacate the invaded lands. In response to these invasions, the president of FEDEGAN, José Félix Laufarié, made a video inviting the landowners to unite to defend themselves against the invasions. And the cost of living crisis continues, affecting Colombia's most vulnerable households most severely. Annual inflation was 10.84% in August, its highest level since 1999. Last month's record inflation was mainly driven by a 25.6% hike in the prices of food and non-alcoholic beverages, along with costs like water, electricity and fuels. The depreciation of the Colombian peso has also meant that products of the basic family basket which are imported, for example cleaning products or inputs for food production, have also raised their prices, contributing to the inflation. Those were your top stories for this week. Thanks for listening.
And we're back. This is segment 3 of episode 439 of the Colombia Calling podcast. I'm here in Bogota, and my very special guest is in Sweden. I think this is the first time we've ever had someone on the line from Sweden. We've had Zambia, but not Sweden. And anyways, I'm talking to Jessica Lopez, PhD in the making. She is Colombian, and she's an expert in sustainable land use at the Center for Environment and Climate Science, and she teaches as well at the Lund University Graduate School for 2030 policy there. But we're going to talk all about the Amazon and security and protection and land use, because it's incredibly polemic right now here in Colombia. So Jessica, welcome on the Colombia Calling podcast.
Hey, Richard. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
It's a real pleasure. Let's start with the very basics, Jessica. How did you end up in between Denmark and Sweden?
That's a good question. Well, as many, many Colombians abroad probably came to the other side of the Atlantic. So, yes, I'm married with a Dane, and then, yeah, we have kids, and the rest is just story.
So I have an idea. Is he, like, you know, 3 meters tall? Does he look like a Viking? as different to a Bogotano as possible?
That could be. That could be a good description. Not as many Danes Viking style, but, yeah, he seems quite Danish.
Okay, very good. So you've been there a long time. I mean, you know, it's something like 14 years.
Yes, almost 14 years now. We moved here, 2009. So wow. A lot of changes, a lot of different processes. And I've been living in Copenhagen, now in Sweden, in the academia, in the private sector, learning a lot about land use, sustainability, etc.
But one last question about this change in lifestyle, because I think of Colombia and I think of the Alegria and I think of, you know, where I am now. And, you know, there's ups and downs like everywhere. And I think of Scandinavia and I think it far more organized. And maybe I know Scandinavians who are amazing and outgoing and talking. But the image in Colombia of a Scandinavian is going to be someone who's cold and like rigid. Is this true, or just put this to sleep now?
Well, I couldn't disagree more. And I think if you have a coin, the two sides of the coin is Colombia and then the Nordics.
Yeah,
it is definitely, there are different people, but in general, Nordics are really, really hard and cold and rough and rough. And, you know, you have to really, really build up relationships. It takes long time. It's not as you go in Bogota and take a taxi and then you have any conversation about, you know, the rain, the traffic, the president. No, here it's like if you ask, hey, sorry, you know where the stop is, they will look at you like somebody's talking to me.
Well, that's right. I mean, here we get into arguments or into great debates with taxi drivers, bus drivers, the lady down the street who sells the chicle. We talk all the time about the weather and so on. In fact, when I was back in London, I was doing that and I was looked at kind of funny by a lot of people. So, you know,
I bet.
This is the great thing that we pick up from Colombia, and this, you know, openness, I think. And so it had to have been an experience to adapt to such a different culture. But now you're over there, you've been working in a solidly, I would say, it's a topic that is this side of the world where we are. You are an expert on the Amazon. I know all your research is Guaviare, Caquetá, Amazonia. And I just thought you could tell us, like, really, what's
going on? What are you focused on? I know one of the main topics is the arc of deforestation that's taking place. Perhaps you could give us a little bit of an explanation, because, you know, I don't know very much about it. I just see photos of fires and I see photos of exploitation and pressure on this vital natural resource. Perhaps you could tell us a bit more, though.
Yes, absolutely. I think it is a really, really important aspect to talk about. I mean, there are so many drivers behind land transformation in the Amazon biome. There has been illegal crops with coca plantations, mining, oil, illegal mining, et cetera, et cetera. But very recently, and specifically after 2016, when the peace agreement was signed between the guerrillas, the FARC, and the government, cattle ranching has been one of the main drivers of deforestation. And specifically, as you mentioned, in Guaviare and Caquetá, where mostly of the deforestation is going on, specifically in between three national natural parks, La Tinigua, La Macarena, and Chiribiquete. And Chiribiquete by excellence, obviously there's an ecological region, but Chiribiquete is the biggest rainforest protected area in the world. It is an amazing hotspot of biodiversity with endemic species, with hydrological systems. It is part of the regulation of climate change, not only the Chiribiquete, but the whole northwestern Amazonia in Colombia. If we look at the biome, then it is connected to the other nine countries with Amazonian regions. So what I do basically, in very general terms, is how this agricultural expansion, how this cattle ranching is detrimenting all these different ecological connectivity corridors in this hotspot of biodiversity. And not what are the main drivers, because basically we have a history of what has happened and how a lot of colonization frontiers have moved there, including the coca, including the mining, et cetera, et cetera. But what I do is, okay, what if we keep on providing or extending this cattle in such a lush and pristine territory? We will have enormous consequences, not only for Colombia, but for the whole Amazonian biome and for the world. It is a climate change regulator. And a lot of the conversations in Colombia are among, okay, they regulate the rains. They have these flying rivers from the footplains of the Amazon up back to the Andes Mountains. And this has, I mean, the relationship between these biomes is the water that cities like Bogota obtain, they are directly attained to the Amazon rainforest. So we have a full complexity of actors, a full complexity of uses of land. And at the same time, we have all the different solutions, because we can see the negative side of it, but there's also so many positive solutions. And I work with intent attempts to change policymaking to have a look at, okay, where can we start thinking not to only see the negative, but also the positive.
Okay, well, I like that way of thinking, because of course we're so exposed to the negative. Because, of course, it sells. You know, I'm a journalist. It sells. The images of the Amazon burning, or the image of the, you know, yeah, a bulldozer going through or something, or the birds, you know, fleeing a forest that's being, you know, knocked down. But it, as you say, it is all connected. Everything is connected. And these ecosystems, biomes, are so very fragile. So perhaps then, rather than talking about the negative, tell me what the positives are. What positives can we take right now then?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Obviously, to understand all the negative things, you have to go and see and how bad it is and talk to the people, to the stakeholders, to the farmers, etc. The positive thing is that, in my eyes, and what I have experienced, is that there is a very welcoming understanding of value nature, much more than it was maybe 30 years ago. Biodiversity started to be one of the negotiations, one of the conversations that was help for the climate change meetings, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of people have started, I mean, there are some actors that are not obviously on that wheel. We will know some of them, no names, but some others are really much into the, well, how can we avoid that, for example, cattle ranching or only agricultural expansion or monocultive in other parts mm-hmm. of the Amazon, such as palm oil or things like that, become the one and single economy.
Mm.
There are a lot of initiatives going on. They're just to spread it out. And I think there's such an urgent need to have an Amazonian hub to discuss all these different initiatives where you can include bioeconomy of different resources, you can include natural produce, alternative proteins, cosmetics, ecotourism. You have all these different lines that economies and livelihoods specifically can become to change a little bit of the mindset of, okay, the land is just for, you know, cattle and I'm a man or I'm a woman that only sells cattle and this goes on and on and on. So I believe firmly that we have an opportunity now in Colombia after all that has happened with the new government and with all the buzzing around the deforestation that has been increasingly accelerating and alarming for the last 5-6 years. And that is something that it's becoming, you know, we are in understanding, we are as Colombians interpreting that nature is valuable, that land is not just, you know, people will think a forest is something that is not for use, then just cut it off. It has to produce. So I think this shift now, which requires a huge paradigm shift, I believe, from government, from civil society, from everyone, it is that finally, we can grab the idea of, well, this forest, standing forest with jaguars, with toucans, with indigenous communities, with farmers from different parts of the country, it can come up to something. It can give us back and we can protect it. We can conserve it. We can make regenerative systems that along nature can support the systems for production / conservation. This is where the positive picture I stick to. And obviously, there's a lot of work to do and it's fascinating.
But you have to stick to it. Otherwise, you get up each morning going, oh, God. But it's the truth. That's such an interesting thing. Is like if we were able to do a sort of mestizaje of these things, in French, you would say like a métissage. I see mm-hmm. it like a piece of string that you bind together to make a full piece of string, you know, like as you said, the cosmetics, the superfruits or whatever, the ecotourism mm-hmm. and everything, and then of course bringing into it food security, of course, you know, which needs to be discussed in this, because that's one of the things that everyone will knock back. Oh yeah, but the country and the land needs to produce because we're not, and now in this economic a disaster that we are living, we need to become self-sufficient. But that doesn't mm-hmm. mean bulldozing the Amazon for more palm oil. You know, that means exactly. A careful planning of how to do this. So, I mean, you know, this is, I see the positives. I see the positives. But how likely are all of these things going to be taken on board? Because there are so many economic interests.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And my fear in Colombia is that there's not enough people with enough power, let's say, to represent the mass, rather than you've got too few people with economic clout who have, you know, obviously significant amount to say and decision making. And so we see, well, you know, and as you were saying, we mentioned no names, but the cattle like that gremio, that union, is so very powerful and political. I don't know how you come up against, because they are like the chief soy oppositor. I am the opposition to this current the presidency now of Gustavo Petro. I mean, they are the ones, and we knew this would happen. But let me before we get into that, let's wind back. Is President Santos, so we're looking at three presidents ago now, or two if you want, he extended Chiribiquete, didn't he? It was him. And then President Duque extended it some more.
I think it was under Santos, 2015, 2018.
Yeah.
Were the 2 years of the expansion. Yeah.
And then, and then Duque then called like the Gran Reunión de Amazonía or algo así, el Gran Foro, which to me sounded a bit more like a, you know, a publicity clip for him. But on the surface, it seems like a good idea that they could get the countries together to talk. But is there any result from this? I mean, have we seen anything?
No, no. I mean, I would say the expansion of the Chiribiquete definitely made a huge, huge step in understanding, okay, we in Colombia have almost 46% of the Amazon biomass territory, and we have to take care of it. But then the Duque administration went, and I think it's one of the biggest criticisms that we discussed with other researchers and other different networks here outside Colombia. It was his attempt of the militarized monitoring of deforestation, the Artemisa. So that was sort of like jeopardizing the main advancements or the main results of the Duque's government campaign for, you know, he had this 180,000 millions of trees that were supposed to be planted as Amazonian reforestation belt. But there was a lot of controversy because, I mean, nobody knew which type of species, nobody knew how many, nobody knew where they, and it was obviously the whole setting of the institutional infrastructure that is not strong enough. So that's the one of the core I would say openings of, okay, why is it that it didn't work? They have good ideas, Vision Amazonia, among others, with support of different governments, including Norway, Germany, and the UK was basically behind all this super, super big locomotora of activation of protecting the Amazon. But then it was all these different approaches. And I would say definitely Duque was campaigning a lot on marketing and publicity, but at the core of the solution, there was not big change. And then we saw during his term the highest ever recorded rates of deforestation in the Colombian Amazon. So I think we are entering, and it's not to become, as we started talking, it's not to become to be negative. But now we need to think urgently that these rates of deforestation are going to have enormous consequences. It's not only that we can stop them and change government. And I mean, it doesn't work like that. These are ecosystems. These are living organisms that regulate themselves. And they don't wait for policymakers. They don't wait for decisions to be taken. They just move. So I believe there's a lot of different research, at least from the Brazilian Amazon, where worst case scenarios are we're going to have, you know, a desertification, a savannization. That means total dryness of the biome in, I don't know, 60 years to come. But I read the other day that we are close to, for the next 15 years, we are close to cross the tipping point. Is if we lose 30% of the total Amazon biome, we will be in a very bad situation against climate change globally. And we are today, right now, 5th of September, at 20%. So if we reach a 10% plus, I see, okay, we should get worried.
Yeah.
But obviously, there is a lot of different people doing good stuff. And I think, and this is what I have learn from the Nordics. There has to be a trust building process. And I think we are getting into that in Colombia, as you say, how with these powerful actors and, you know, the cattle ranching gremio is very strong. And this is something that, I mean, if they want to become the sustainable cattle productive figure as they promote themselves, they have to deal with the trade-offs that come along with this transition and transformation to be open about the land distribution, land tenure, environmental justice, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many layers. But I know many Colombians and many other people that we are working to give this message across with our research, with our campaigning, social societies, just highlighting the importance of not Brazilian Amazon as the one and only, but the whole biome as a living organism that has to be thought. But coming back to your first question, I don't think the whole idea of the Duque government, came up with nothing to go there. So we have a lot of work to do.
I think, you know, I think, like you say, it was a lot of noise. And we must appreciate the publicity given, because that's what it generated. 100%. But I don't think they went much beyond that. I think it was very much, it burned very bright for a very short amount of time and then went away. And I also think that we were in his 2 years when President Duque was out looking for a new job. And he's always wanted to be the sort of older statesman and an environmental defender type person. So I think this all played into his future, what would you say, CV or resume?
Yes.
I think there was
for
a lot,
because
we do know that he was knocking on doors for about 2 years.
So, there has to be a reason. I mean, it wasn't just because he wanted it.
But I think it, I mean, you know, there are, and you raise that point, it's not just, the Amazon's not just in Brazil. Yes. A massive amount is not just in Brazil, and it doesn't end at borders. Like you say, they all connect. This is a side note. My dad was Canadian. He used to get really, really annoyed when he was in the US, because when he was watching the weather forecast, it stopped at the border, so he couldn't see what was going on in Canada. But I see that kind of attitude towards the Amazon. You know, okay, well, that's Colombia, and that's Peru, and that's Bolivia, and that's Venezuela. Now, I got some really fascinating figures this morning from COICA. It's an indigenous, isn't it? Unity type of people, a press release. And they say the aim that we should be looking at is to save 80% of what is still here by 2025. Obviously, you know, working with the knowledge of the indigenous people on the ground who know how this. And then there were figures further down, which I found absolutely, I mean, terrifying, is that 34% of the Brazilian Amazon is under pressure or at threat. 24% of the Bolivian Amazon, 16% of the Ecuadorian, 14% of the Colombian, and 10% of the Peruvian. So 90% of all of that thing is in Brazil and Bolivia. But you can't rule out the others like Ecuador, Colombia, Peru, because it's all together. I mean, these figures coming out are just terrifying. And I want to ask, though, when you are doing all these studies on land transformation, how do you map it? I mean, because you've been down there. How do you actually... I mean, is it with satellites? Are you with drones? What are you doing when you're down in the field?
Yes, that's a really nice question. I mean, first of all this, as you said, all this biome is composed and it's one connected environment in all these countries. But it's also very important to remember that this very specific spot in the world, specifically in what it is, Brazil, Venezuela, Colombia and Ecuador, and Peru, is the Guiana Shield. And this Guiana Shield, it is a very, very particular type of environment. And it has, it's very, very interesting in terms of geology, morphology, anthropology. It has so many different, you know, components.
Do you have an idea for a great new podcast? You can bring your idea to life and start your podcast today with Libsyn. Our podcast has been on Libsyn for, 9 years, and we love it. Libsyn has everything you need to plan, launch, and grow your own podcast. Libsyn provides some of the best resources created by expert podcasters who will show you everything you need to know, like what equipment you should use, how to record great audio, how to get your show onto Apple Podcasts and other popular platforms, and much more. Plus, As a friend of Columbia Calling, when you sign up with Libsyn, you get your first month of podcast hosting for free. There has never been a better time than right now for you to start podcasting. Visit libsyn.com and use code FRIEND, that's FRIEND, and that's Libsyn, that's LIBSYN.com, and use the code FRIEND to get started and create your podcast today. So perhaps you could tell us, Jessica, a little bit about the shield, the Guyanese shield.
Yes. Yeah. Coming back to how important it is to think about the Amazon as a huge biome, as one single biome. The Guyana shield is one of the regions of highest biodiversity globally. And it has super many endemic species. And you have also the tepuis, which are these super famous mountain table tops that are across Venezuela, Colombia, in Brazil. But the Guyana shield also combines interconnection, the Andes and the foothills and the Orinoco. So you have one of these super interesting, biographically rich area, and then this is working together. But then once you add governments and borders and policies and all these different, then it becomes not the shield anymore, basically. And I think that's one of the efforts that institutions or organizations such as COICA are really, really working towards. And there's also a bunch of different, there's Gaia as well in Colombia, the RAISC, the Geographical Association in Brazil, et cetera, et cetera. But then you were asking me, okay, how do I monitor? How do I go and make my field work? And how do I relate? So taking into account that I cannot isolate units or agents, let's say, I study basically social ecological systems. So how humans can change that ecology or transform or adapt. So what I do is work with stakeholders. I do a lot of interviews. I do a lot of systems thinking approach systems, which is conceptual modeling, basically. I go and play around with different conceptual models of all the different questions combined with geographical systems and spatial analysis. So one thing that I do is go and download tons and tons of different data, satellite data, where you can follow real-time information on forest fires and also where you can see how many hectares have been moving. What we're trying to do now is how to associate those deforested areas specifically to cattle. Because it has a very specific identification analysis, and you have some specific units that you cannot recognize. The Amazon biome, sometimes if you go to the Chiribiquete, for example, if you go there and go and make a satellite imagery analysis, you will see the green carpet basically in many of the spaces. But once you go to the frontier where the agricultural is going on, then you can see, well, there is some agroforestry systems, there's some combination of trees, or there could be reservoir of water. But once you jump and zoom in even more, 10 meters resolution, 30 meters resolution, then you will have specific units that can recognize what are the units, the cattle rancher house or the pot of water that is set for the cattle, or even the super clear cut and burning of the forest right next to a grassland or a pasture that has been recently opened. So what we're doing now is asking people, okay, not only because there's a lot of information basically, but in Colombia, the IDEAM, the Institution for Hydrology and Meteorology, they have all sorts of data, but these data are super delayed. So now there's a Planet, there is the Maryland University with Global Forest Watch information, et cetera, et cetera. So all those data have to be controlled and attained for quality data as well. And what we do is work with modeling and specifically recognition of what are the specific units in the landscapes that show us where is the cattle moving and how was the track of the cattle in those 100 hectares and how it's moving to these 300. And we are accumulating these numbers, and then we can probably think and say, well, if these are the numbers that have been increasing from 2016, we can say, well, these will be the numbers that might probably be in 2030. And why not 2050 if we keep in the same curve of acceleration, for example? So I do a lot of interviewing, and I did an overfly a tour with Fundación para la Conservación on the 4th of February this year, which was the highest number of fires per hour registered ever. And that was incredible, because one thing is go and see from above how it is, but a whole different thing is feeling the heat of the humid tropics together with those fires in that tiny little bit, like super tiny, a small flight.
You're in like a little, I mean, like a flying egg up there above the...
Exactly.
But this isn't done with the military. This is done with, environmental agencies, right?
Yes, part of it. Yeah, I mean, it's not at all recommendable to do it just by yourself. I mean, it has to do with a lot of security issues and research purposes, et cetera, et cetera. But one thing is satellite imagery nowadays is helping us to see and follow the trends. But another thing is going and saying, well, we have to stop basically this frontier to advance, because then we risk to come into this so-called 30% of tipping point from all, I mean, compared to talking about Brazil, in Argentina, in Cerrado, in Brazil, it's already an emitter. They're sending enormous amounts of greenhouse emissions to the air right now. And this is something that is going to happen in the future, potentially, from the other Amazonian countries. So now we have the opportunity, or at least the chance, to click on the button and say, well, we better get doing some good stuff about planning, management, securing food security, combining the nexus between land studies and food studies, and giving opportunities not only for farmers and indigenous peoples, but also for consumers in the big cities to know where exactly this meat specifically is coming from. Because it is a lot about information. It is a lot about the voice to voice. And there is a bunch, I mean, our new minister, Susana Muhammad, has said of the environment, she said, well, we need to set up a traceability that is connected to this enormous supply chain. But then where comes this supply chain actor that can change everything? It's the consumer.
Yeah.
So I guess we need to start talking about it as well.
I was actually going to ask you about the new minister, Susana Muhammad. I mean, how do you feel? My pinko liberal background, although I am not a vegetarian, I do like a steak, I am fine with this idea, but with this idea of traceability. I would like to know that this came from an area that's designated for cattle farming and not an expansion into Amazonian. I am 100% in agreement with this, just like we know where, let's say, if we're in Europe, fruit is where it's coming from. I want to buy locally. I want to buy. Why can't we do the same with beef or something? I don't know. I mean, I want to know as well that the chicken is free range, for example. Mm-hmm. Isn't it just an evolution? It's just the next step. But the Gremio is going crazy.
Yeah. It's true. I mean, it is, and it comes with trends. You know, specifically here in Europe and mostly in the Nordics, the new generations are starting to become much more conscious about the provenance of their what they consume. And this is not only food, but also, you know, clothing and fuel and et cetera, et cetera. So as you say, we are really, really far behind in terms of technology, let's say, to put it in those terms. But at the same time, as you mentioned before, there is also the risk of not taking the right and proper actors to begin the conversation. Mm. So it is a question of power, first of all. There is a lot of power in this supply chain globally. But then when you zoom it out to Brazil, then, well, their first country, these exporters of meat. But then Colombia, what they want to is this sector, what they want to is to, you know, become one of the potential exporters of meat. And now we have, for example, latest data that I've read not long ago, it's we are exporting meat to Russia, Lebanon, Egypt. And this is in form of living cattle and dead cattle. So this is becoming to it is started as if it was just, you know, the domestic problem in meat that was sent from Villavicencio to Bogotá, Medellín, Cali, from, you know, provenance in unknown territories in the Amazon. But now the whole sector is obviously getting higher and higher in interest in how can we become this, you know, potential exporter, as same as Brazil and Argentina. Obviously, we're not going to get at the same levels to compete to those super crazy potential cattle exporters. Same time, it makes you think, well, after the 2016 peace agreement, as guerrillas move away, as you might also have heard, all these territories were untouched and locked. And land grabbers and land tenure owners started to come. And then suddenly, in the same years, especially in COVID years, the GDP, the GDP from the cattle sector was increasing a lot compared to going in parallel to what the hectares of deforestation went increasing in the Amazon. There's no such a clear evidence that, you know, these two are connected, but it is obviously one attempt to go and have much more territory for cattle. And we have a specific area in the northern part of Colombia and in the Orinoquia that has been devoted to cattle, sustainable and unsustainable practices. There's a whole different chapter. But those areas have to be the ones to keep on going rather than expanding and using even more land in places like Amazon. It's as if you give a children 3,000 grams of sugar per day, you are giving these cattle access to 300 hectares per second. It is crazy. It's not the proper thing to do. And I think we have the opportunity and we have to have the conversation in Colombia and with other governments to start thinking to protect more biodiversity, more ecosystem services, more people, instead of the profit of, you know, growth of industries and sectors. And this has been such a complex issue from many countries. But I do believe we're going to change and transform.
Well, I think there's a greater understanding by a younger generation. I really do. Mm-hmm. And when you speak to young Bogotanos, costeños, young people from Medellin or elsewhere, I think you start seeing it. Unfortunately, we are urban dwellers. We're not out there on the frontier seeing what life is like. I mean, there's a big difference. But these questions and everything and the statements and the declarations that we make, and you and I in this conversation, it comes back to this one issue at the end, and it's land ownership and land use, which of course, point number one on the peace agreement. I mean, point number one, if we were to sort of, let's say, unravel a lot of the Colombian conflict, of course, there are so many different, obviously, issues that come in, but land is that thing, and land is equated to wealth. We need to equate the wealth of the land to the biodiversity of the land and what it means as as a community as a whole. I understand that, and like you said, there are areas in the Orinoquia, so I imagine sort of Meta and Casanare, that have always been dedicated to cattle farming. Córdoba, Sucre, sort of northern Antioquia. Yes. Why should we be pushing the frontiers? Why can't we? Because I drive up to the coast every now and then, up to Mompós, and we go through the areas of Cesar, lots of cattle farming. And of course, when you pass places near to Agua Chica and there's at Morrison, there's palm oil.
Exactly.
But it's always been. You know, that area, and that has always been. And so I have no issue with it. This has been the expansion.
Yeah.
But to deforest for more, it just seems, well, of course, I mean, you and I, we're on the same page. But how, I mean, like you said, there are organizations working for this that we are, you know, there is a greater conscience. We do have a government in place that is aware of this. You know, that action needs to be taken. Now, you did mention, and we'll finish on this because otherwise it will go, we can talk for hours, but that you did mention the Operación Artemis, wasn't it? Artemis or Artemisa?
Yeah, Artemisa.
That was to militarize the jungle, right? To ensure. But if there are high-ranking political figures involved in the expansion, I'm saying this very carefully because I'm located in Colombia.
Yes, I know.
High-ranking political figures involved in this, and the military obviously is very aligned with the government. Did it work, the militarization of the jungles to protect it?
Well, there is obviously the line in between those that are saying yes, it was right, and those that are saying it wasn't. I think it is a super important topic, and this goes, I mean, I don't research in that, but I deal a lot with it. It goes in the environmental peace building processes. Mm. So what it is here, all the Artemisa was basically, brilliant enough, put it all together. It was an attempt for the government to say, we're going to tackle those, you know, bad boys. But suddenly, all these bad boys were the ones that they wanted to pick up. And this started to become to be selective for small and medium farmers. The bigger actors, the big investors, names across, all of them had relationships with the different political and governmental entities that were, I mean, you can add corruption, you can add road system, you can add all the different layers, that's for clear. But what Artemisa did was a huge, huge mistake in misusing the resources to protect forest and to protect livelihoods. And it was a lot, it just disturbed the whole conversation of how can we get to, you know, to the point that we don't expand and we don't detriment land. We're not only talking about deforestation, but also degradation. So if we continue with these high levels of deforestation, we will have degraded soils. That means no opportunities for anyone to build and cultivate the land. So Artemisa was totally blind in saying, we're going to militarize. I mean, there's tons and tons and tons of money figures here. I don't know the exact number, but there's billions of dollars, I will dare to say, that could have been invested in so many different ways, in so many different extensive ways, with education, with programs, with, building knowledge, introducing and exchanging knowledge between indigenous people and farmers and academia and civil actors, etc., etc. They could be 100% reliable on, okay, security is one reason. Yes, it was a difficult territory, no doubt. Colombia has a very, very, you know, specific story, 60 years of internal conflict, and these areas were obviously a nightmare in terms of security, many others in Colombia. But at the same time, this attempt, and obviously to close down, because I know we can keep on talking, this is something that in many other countries, even in Africa, in tropical countries that have had problems like that, they already failed, and there was evidence about it, and there were results, and there was a lot of different organizations such as FAO, UN, World Bank, you name it, telling, please don't use the approach for the militarized control. And then it's like, well, why then our dear Duque, did something like that? No, all my respect to all these people. But anyway, how didn't they think that there was a whole different layer of opportunities rather than going to militarize? And if you continue then, just from my very personal view, combined with my experience in sustainable land management, never go for the, you know, just build peace, just go and try to have dialogues. And I think we are coming to that. But Artemisa, in my eyes, was one of the biggest failures of the control of deforestation.
Yeah. And I mean, it'd be just, as you said, Dear Duque, the solution of his government to almost everything was militarization. And, you know, it's been proven and disproven and whatever else. But exactly. I think you say it's the, you know, the dialogue needs to continue. The people on the ground need to be involved. And there are so many different entities doing good work rather than doing that. And I think that's, you know, that's what we leave. I want to just say one of the things that you said, and I just want to bring it back because it was just so awesome, is like, you know, these biomes are living organisms. They don't wait for policy. I'm going to use that in publicity for this because I think it's just so good. Let me take this moment, Jessica, and say thank you so much for your time. It really has been enlightening and fun and to talk about this and to learn so much more. So when can we expect you to become the Minister for the Environment?
Well, I really expect, I mean, I have high expectations, but what I really want her to talk about is...
No, you, I want you to be the Minister for the Environment.
Well, no, politics is not my thing.
Because you weren't at all political in this conversation, not at all.
No, I'm far from that. I stay where I am right now.
Okay, well, very good.
Thank you so much, Richard. I really enjoyed our conversation, and thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to Jessica Lopez, who's there in Sweden, in Lund, and you know, just to be able to have someone who's so, you know, really, you have just made it so very clear. You know, sometimes we get academics who speak in pure academia, and it's a little bit difficult, but this has been very, very accessible even to people such as myself, and I can get lost on so many things. So thank you again for your time, and please keep writing the reports and keep getting the information out there so that we can keep this in an international conversation.
100%. I'm really looking forward for the new years to come. Thank you so much, Richard.
Excellent. So we've been talking to Jessica Lopez. This has been episode 439 of the Columbia Calling podcast. I'll put a link up to her articles, her academic articles online. And of course, please subscribe, tune in, share, check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/Columbia Calling. And now we'll go over to some messages from our sponsors. Thank you again for listening and bye-bye. This episode was brought to you by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean. Since 1967, their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. And also, our other sponsor is BNB Colombia Tours, experts in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. The team at BNB Colombia Tours can provide you with fantastic private experiences, creating wonderful memories of Colombia for a lifetime. Check out the website at bnbcolombia.com, complete the free itinerary form, and tell them that Columbia Calling sent you to receive a further 5% off their already great prices. So that's bnbcolombia.com and, of course, latinnews.com. Thank you for everyone for listening. That's us. Farewell. And, of course, check back next week. Bye-bye.